Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Keith Harmon Snow. He's a writer, photographer, and naturalist. This is his third program with me focused on rare cats of the world. In 1993, he exposed a high-level racket in Japan involving trade in endangered species. Today, we talk about tigers. So can you give us a start with an overview of tigers? Who are they? What's their ecological history? And so on.
Thank you, Derek, for having me on. And sure, let's look at the tiger as the biggest wild cat. There are 40 cats in the classification system, the taxonomy, where tigers are at the top, the largest. They're substantially larger than the largest African lion. And some of the smaller cats are like the ones we did in the last show, the two cats from Japan. And within this group of 40, you have tigers, lions, leopards, some of the most rare predators on planet Earth at this point, down to, in some cases, very, very small numbers, 100 individuals or less. For example, the Florida panther, which is considered to be a subspecies. But that's panther, that's not tiger. So the tiger is the bigger one. And they have recorded Korean tiger from mainland China up near North Korea, was captured, I believe it was 1938. And this tiger measured 12 feet long with a 3-foot tail. And as I say, people should measure that out and see what that means in terms of their footprint being a foot long, for example, and see just how big that is. That's substantial. What's really interesting is that they're, in many places, they're virtually impossible to see. How could something so big be so well hidden? So back to the subject of the tiger's history, for example, that somewhere along the lines, saber-toothed tigers and modern-day tigers were genetically connected and evolved accordingly to what we have today, which once upon a time, 200 BC, which is the first record of a tiger that is in any kind of a written script, tigers were at that time probably and certainly ranged across all of parts of Russia, North and South Korea, down through China, especially Southeast China, and across to Burma, India, Nepal, Bhutan, all the way over to parts of Pakistan, and kept going at that time through Iran and all the way to Turkey, Iraq, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, they all had tigers. Today, and of course, they were wiped out in most areas, leading to what we have today, which are very, very small pockets of populations in about 9 or 10 or 12 what are called tiger range countries. So today they only exist in India, Nepal, Bhutan, Burma. I'm going to use the people's term for Burma, not Myanmar. Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, China, the Russian Federation. I think that's everybody. And they're, as I say, in very small populations in these places. And if you look at for example, the size of China, imagine that they used to roam widely over China and widely over Russia. And today, the numbers in China are incredibly small. The largest population today is in India, which is the Bengal tiger. Before I get into the numbers of tigers in different places, for example, I just want to mention that there's two schools of thought, and they're fighting with each other about the classification of Panthera, the largest cats in the tiger subclassification. And so in one of these schools of thought or groups who are fighting with the other one, there's only two species. There's the mainland tigers, which are India, China, Russia, Thailand. I don't know about Malaysia. And then the Sunda tigers. Are you still there?
Yep.
Okay. And then the Sunda Tigers, which are considered to be tigers that have geographically been separated from the other mainland population by the islands, which comprise what is today the last remains of the Sunda Shelf. At one point, this was a part of the continent of Asia that stretched all the way down into the far tip of Bali and included Kalimantan and Borneo, Sarawak and Kalimantan, did not include the Philippines and did not include Papua New Guinea. So somewhere that today the Sunda Shelf is not terribly deep. It's like a maximum 50 meters anywhere. But then, of course, you know, over as it go towards the Philippines, it's much, much deeper in water there. So there was this landmass where the tigers roamed freely from all the way from Russia down to Indonesia over time. And then as the islands developed, the tigers could cross back and forth by water, swimming and such. But basically, they became isolated populations and they developed accordingly. And something really interesting is something called Bergman's rule, which applies to the tiger. This guy, Bergman, from 1880 or something like that, he came up with this rule, and that says that members of a population of a certain species will diverge in size according to the geography where they live. So according to Bergman's rule, the largest tigers would be in the colder zones, Korea's, far eastern Russia, and at that time, Kyrgyzstan, et cetera. And the smaller tigers would be down in the far south tip of Indonesia. And that's exactly what plays out. So the Balian tiger, the tiger on the island of Bali, and the Sumatran tiger, and the Java tigers were the smallest. Bali and Java were actually smaller than the Sumatran tiger, even though they're very close together. And these were substantially smaller than the largest Siberian and Manchurian tigers. And so that's why they classify these two types. There's these all these ones that came from the Sunda Shelf Islands, and then there's the ones on the mainlands. But then there's another school that says there are 9 subspecies. And these are according to, kind of seems like they're sort of according to who discovered them. There's a little bit of that ego stuff playing out as far as I'm concerned. But at the same time, they are genetically different in some ways, in enough ways that some people believe that there should be 9 subspecies. So those 9 subspecies, some of them, 3 of those are already extinct. And just to complete this quick overview of the tiger, for example, for our listeners' concern and interest, I think we're down to somewhere between 3,800 and 5,700 tigers left in the wilds in the world. And at one point, those numbers were substantially less. And in 2010, there was a big tiger push to get all these tiger countries that have tiger habitat and historically had tigers to work together to try to double the population by 2023. They didn't double it, but they did increase it substantially in most countries. In a couple of countries, the tigers declined substantially. And we could, you know, we're going to talk about obviously why tigers are absent or present. The absent question is the most pressing in a certain way. But so that's sort of an overview of the status of Panthera tigris, the largest, what everybody knows to be one of the most beautiful animals on the planet. And also, I should mention, in terms of numbers, there's over 7,000 captive tigers in the United States. It's way above the wild tiger population. This is a big business. I've done some research for about 7 years, from 2008 to 2014. I was looking into what I called my tiger expose. So there's connections of the tiger trade. It's the third largest illicit trade in the world, right up there with trafficking in women and children, and animal parts is like number 3, and then drugs is right up there too. And they're all intertwined, and the same in some places and times, the same people that are trafficking children and women are trafficking tiger parts. And tiger parts are in great demand, especially in China, but not only, for their skins, because people want to lay out their rug on the ground with a big tiger head, and for their bones, because in Chinese pharmacopoeia, there was this belief. It's a false belief because in history, China did not value the tiger for its bone. It's only become a more recent development. It's actually been removed. The tiger has been removed from the formal Chinese medical pharmacopoeia, what they do and don't consume, et cetera, or believe in. So, but it's still driving a huge trade in tiger bone and tiger skull and tiger toenails, for example, because it's a big profitable business with a lot of, myth and superstition, and the whiskers and the teeth and the skulls and the meat and the skins and the tails and the whole tiger, skin pieces, the claws and the bones are all the different parts that are sought after for different reasons. And if you love this cat, it's really heartbreaking to think that someone would kill one of these giant beasts to cut them up for that sort of thing. So I'll take a pause and see if you have a question.
Yeah, let's thank you for all that. And let's back up a little bit. And can you talk about, I'm always hesitant to say ecological function because I don't want to make everybody utilitarian, but can you talk a little bit about whom do they eat? Do they serve, again, similar function? I know when wolves get reintroduced to a place, one of the things that they do is improve habitat for everybody else by chasing the herbivores around and making it so the herbivores don't get lazy and eat all the food in the best habitat. And there's also, I'm going to totally butcher this, but there's this beautiful line about how the sharpness of the wolf's tooth is what carved the delicate legs of the, deer's leg. And once again, it's a much more beautiful line than that. But can you talk about, and the point being that they make predator or make prey more lively and faster. So can you talk about A, whom they eat and what some of the roles they play in their communities?
Sure, I can do my best. Well, given that they're considered, let's assume there are 9 subspecies and they're in very different geographical places and Bergman's rule applies. And by the way, Allen's rule also applies. And that's an eco-geographical rule that says in a colder area, any member of a certain population, like tigers in this case, tigers in the north versus tigers in the south, in a colder area, tigers will have shorter, thicker limbs than they will. They'll be more skinny and lanky down in the southern, warmer areas. And that makes a lot of sense. But anyway, you asked me about what they feed and what. So given that they range, that their current range, and we have to be careful with that term because it suggests that they can move from, where they can move from and to. In some places, these tiger populations are incredibly restricted, surrounded by a sea of humanity. And it's just they're hanging on by their fingernails, quite literally. And so their range may be restricted to 50 miles or 1,000 square kilometers in certain parks in India or Nepal or in Sumatra, for example. So that, as people can imagine, the biomes are very, very different. If we talk about the Siberian tiger, it's going to eat large antelope, large deer, species similar to elk and moose that they have in Russia, and all the way down to small mammals. The tiger will go after small mammals. It's not an opportunistic feeder, so to speak. Whereas what I mean by that is a tiger doesn't generally go after carrion. It's not really a scavenger, but it will eat something if it comes upon it, and it will also chase down small mammals that because it's hungry. But if it has access to the big prey species, the big deer and such, and the competitors for a tiger include jaguars in some places and panthers and sun bears in Malaysia. So that the island biodiversity down in the south means that the species and the prey that the tiger feeds on are very different from those in Kamchatka, for example. And so down on an island like Sumatra, they'll feed on deer, which don't get nearly as big as the deer up in Kamchatka. Although in India, there's some very big deer, like and antelopes. The Nilgai, for example, isn't one of the tiger's favorite snacks. The Nilgai is its blue antelope, which is a blue antelope deer. It's not classified. There's some discussion about whether it's a deer or antelope. But anyway, and the tigers will feed on ungulates like that, deer, and certainly cattle if they can get their hands on them, their paws on them. And small rodents, larger rodents, primates, if the tigers can get an orangutan, and for example, in Sumatra, in Malaysia, they would do that. And they're carnivores, so they eat, you know, strictly meat, no plant-based diets. And the tiger being at the, you know, I hesitate to use this term because it's people don't understand it, but I'm going to use it, apex predator. It's other than man, it's the top of the food chain. In a certain way, we're not at the top of the food chain. We're just a, you know, I don't know how you would explain that, but I would explain that as a plague on nature. And so the tiger keeps the forest healthy. If the tiger populations are doing well, the forest is doing well. And some of the indigenous people definitely make an equation between the health of their forest and the health of the local species, including especially the tiger.
So you brought up range. Can you, and again, it's going to be different depending on the locale, but what would be some typical ranges for tigers back when they're not, when they weren't being pressured by or destroyed by humans and industrial humans? Agricultural.
Yeah,
humans.
We covered a couple numbers that I wanted to throw out before that I didn't. In 1900, there were 100,000 tigers in the wild, and now in the year 2000, there were well less than what we have now because they didn't double them, but they did increase the numbers. So, and a tiger's range is, in some places, they're restricted to, the numbers are given in terms of some of the statistics of infant mortality. I don't mean infant, I mean juvenile mortality of tigers, for example. Less than half tiger cubs will live to be 2 years old. And part of the problem is the ranges of these tigers are reduced substantially by the habitat loss, down to anything from 30 square miles to, you know, 1,000 kilometers. Sorry about mixing up those numbers. A tiger needs a habitat of about 60 square miles minimum, and they can be known to range 1,000 miles. And they can't range 1,000 miles. They, you know, I said what I said before about these islands of populations of tigers around Asia and Siberia, for example. But the fact that there are these reserves where these tigers live doesn't mean that they don't range outside of the reserve. They certainly do. And one of the pushes currently with tigers is to create corridors between these places, these little populations, so that there's more genetic variability and viability, as has been done with the jaguar in the now very huge jaguar corridor that's been established in Latin America.
So what are the, sorry to just keep asking you questions at which, you know, you kind of have to guess, but if the population was 100,000 in 1900, after they'd already been hammered, just make a complete guess as to what the population might have been the original healthy population was it 1 million, 2 million, you think? I mean, again,
yeah.
I fully know that you're just guessing.
It's totally a wild guess, but if we can imagine what the world looked like, this part of the world, for example, looked like when these rainforests were intact and these savannas were intact, and before humanity started spreading like a plague over the land in all these places and conquest and war. And I mean, let's talk about why there are no tigers left in certain countries. And you can extrapolate backwards. And so, for example, in India, the Raj, these sultanates, hunting was huge. And the first real records of the hunting that went on in India started about 1850, 1830. And that was because the British colonists had colonized India, and the British were going down there and doing all this hunting along with the sultanates, you know. And at the time, you know, 18-something, 1830, the numbers, for example, in 1850, there were substantial tigers in Java, the island. And they had already put out a bounty for tigers to kill them as vermin in the 1830s. In 1938, the natural forest covered 23% of the island of Java. And by 1975, it only covered 8%. In 1900, there were 28 million people in Java. In 1975, there were 85 million. So if we look at those numbers and try to extrapolate backwards on the tiger, you have to try to close your eyes. You have to close your eyes and try to imagine tigers everywhere, and leopards, and, you know, rhinoceroses in the Indian subcontinent, all the way up into Nepal and Bhutan, and the ibex, the giant, one of the species prey of the clouded leopard, for example, would also have been on the lower ends of the range of certain tiger populations. And certainly at that time, long, long ago, the ibex, which is very rare today, would be one of the prey species of the bigger tigers at the time. It's really hard to even imagine. You know, when we talk about Pocahontas and Captain John Smith and that era in 16-something down in what's now Washington, D.C., before the slave markets existed, before they built the Washington Memorial and the Lincoln Memorial on top of them, the fish were so thick that there's all these records of Native Americans going down and scooping them out with pitchforks. And if we extrapolate that to land before humans did what we did, there must have been tigers everywhere. And at the same time, you know, they're a very elusive species. So I would say there were at least millions of tigers, you know, 100, you know, 1,000 years, 2,000, 3,000, 300 BC, whatever, somewhere around there. Somewhere maybe 5,000-10,000 years before that, or in the 20,000 years ago era, there were probably millions of tigers.
So before we move to more contemporary issues, can you talk about roughly when they were eradicated from the Near East?
Yeah, well, under Chinese, the Mao Zedong's great leap forward, the numbers that in China that were already substantially reduced just plummeted, and China's populations pretty much disappeared before 1975. So the current tiger range, well, you asked about the Near East. If people have not been to Shanghai, for example, it's an industrialized nightmare. And that's true of much of the South China coast. And I actually did some study of the South China coast in the 1600 era when the Spaniards first arrived in the Philippines, and they started to war with the Chinese coming down from the mainland. And at that time, it was, you know, the habitat had already been substantially diminished in eastern China, the habitat of the tiger. And so the numbers at that point, 16-something, must have been way down already in China. In Mongolia, there were tigers at one point, and those were gone by 1900. I can't give you a better formulation of how the numbers declined exactly when in China, but today there's less than 50 in all of China, less than 50 tigers. These are, I'm going to give people some 2023 numbers because there was just a big, there was this push to double the numbers of China's in the, of tigers in the world by 2023 over a decade. And so they did a measurement and all the numbers came in last year. China is down to less than 50 tigers, and those are all up on the border with North Korea. It's unknown whether there are any tigers in North Korea. There may be, there may not be. But once upon a time, tigers did roam the entire Korean peninsula. And, you know, these are the ones that went up and down through Kamchatka and the far eastern Soviet republics, etc. Bhutan, up there next to Nepal, is down to 131 tigers today. Nepal has, in 2010, Nepal had 121. In 2022, they have 335, which is remarkable, given all of the pressures that, you know, tigers are facing and threats that they're facing. The Russian Federation, possibly North Korea, has some ranging in and out. They're somewhere between, in 2005, they were 331 to 393. And in 2014, they were 562. And today, they're believed to be around 600 in the Russian Federation, which I think is remarkable as well, because I don't want to be discriminatory against Russians. There's, you know, organized crime in every single country that we're talking about, including the United States. But the organized crime in the Russian Federation around tigers and their value has been substantial, which is part of the reason the numbers are down. The other reason is obviously logging, industrialized logging, massive, massive destruction of habitat in Russia, in Kamchatka. And Burma has wonderfully a brand new conservation area that was created in Burma to protect the tiger. It's one of the most recently developed conservation areas. I think the Burma numbers of tigers are in the 200-300 range. Malaysia, there's less than 150 tigers in 2020. I don't have the 2023 number. Vietnam, zero. Cambodia, zero. Laos, zero. Why? These countries like Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Indochina. Thailand has around 148 to 189 tigers today. It's doubled since 2014, and I believe it's tripled since I was there, since I was exploring tiger habitat in Thailand in 1990. The tigers in 1990 were down to almost none in Thailand. And I said Nepal, Malaysia. So why Bhutan? Bangladesh has 106 tigers are considered to be in the Bangladesh section of the Sundarbans. And in the Indian section of the Sundarbans, there's a good size as well. The Sundarbans are the huge, huge mangrove forest, mangrove estuary and swamp between on the border of Bangladesh and India, one of the most, in my opinion, fascinating places on earth, and very interesting stories about the relationships between people and tigers there. So why are there no tigers left in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, Derek?
Is that a real question or a rhetorical question?
It's a real question, Derek.
Okay, I'm going to guess. Well, I mean, the standard guesses are habitat loss and poaching.
Agent Orange.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
The war, the American war in Indochina. For example, we dropped, 80 million bomblets that are the size of a baseball that are still unexploded in Laos. 80 million of these baseball-sized bomblets that are taking children's arms and legs as we speak. Nobody knows this. Nobody knows the history of the U.S. illegal bombing of Laos, or very few people do. Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam during the so-called war, you know, the so-called Vietnam War, which is the American war. We just wiped out the tiger populations and so many other species, and they're still, you know, the species are still dying, and people are still dying from all of those Agent Orange toxic chemicals that we dumped, napalm that we dumped on the landscape. And the same thing with the bombs, you know. So that's why there's no tigers left there. India is the success story. Because the Indian Raj back in, you know, 1850 or even longer before that started conserving and became conservationists because they were hunters. They wanted to hunt. They wanted to make sure the species didn't die off. They started conservation, you know, 100, 200 years ago. And so in India, there's something like, what is it, over 3,000 tigers today? Hold on a second. In 2022, there was 3,167 tigers measured, an increase of 298, substantial increase from 2018 when there were 2,461 tigers. So India is the success story in terms of sheer supposed numbers. And I have to put an asterisk on that and say, well, who's measuring and what standards and how do we know that those numbers are true and why would they deviate? And why would anybody present false numbers anywhere? So I'll take a breath and drink a little bit of my tea while you formulate a question if you want to.
Well, it's not so much a question as is a response that as you're saying all this, I find myself both heartbroken and, well, three things, heartbroken, despairing, and then encouraged. Because when you're saying that there's a species who's down to 300 in a large region, or 150, or any of the numbers you threw out, that is heartbreaking and terrifying to me. And part of the reason it's terrifying is that means that one unexpected event could kill them all. One quick epidemic of some sort of disease or something, even excluding the grinding away of the culture. So that's the bad parts, and then also the fact that this is happening, you know, to everybody. We could be having the same conversation about, you know, salmon are just completely getting hammered. It doesn't matter which species we talk about. Chances are good that they're in trouble. But then the other part that brings me great joy is how quickly there is some rebound. And that points for me toward one of the, I mean, life really wants to live, and so much of what we have to do is just leave them alone and stop killing them. But anyway, so first,
You nailed it in several points there.
Yeah. So address any of those points, please.
Well, it's heartbreaking.
Like
I mean,
you made a specific noise when I said something about how some sort of catastrophic event could wipe them all out because the numbers are so small.
Right. That was I started to interrupt and realized I wanted to let you speak. I apologize. So I mean that falls under the threats to tigers section, which I mean I'm just going to run through it quickly. These are the reasons tigers are in decline. And even though the numbers have doubled in some of these parks, and even though there are some corridors and there's some new thinking about tigers and new interest, it's all about economy of scale, which I've said before in my interview with you. So the threats to the tigers historically and currently, mining, runoff, and the use of all these chemicals that they use in mining where they create these giant acid pools and other nasty stuff that nothing can survive. And that pollution is really causing a problem. But there's the mining itself and the pollution. So oil and natural gas exploration and extraction in any place we talk about, except maybe Bhutan and Nepal. I don't know if they're doing it there, but they surely will if they can. Rainforest destruction is sort of an obvious one, and the different reasons are habitat fragmentation caused by human agriculture and aquaculture and and cutting down the forest, selling it to Japan or the United States or whoever, and monoculture plantations. Tigers don't like monoculture plantations because there's no diversity in them. They're also generally treated with chemicals and sprayed and herbicides. Tigers don't like them, and they die off when they get in the vicinity of them. So rainforest destruction, you know, the indigenous peoples are faced with the kinds of stuff that you see over and over and over. You know, we talk about genocide. We talk about, if we apply it to the tigers, we would say, you know, speciesicide or ecocide. And so monocultures, poisons, there's a lot of poisoning of tigers because they come in, kill a few goats, or they kill a few cattle, or somebody doesn't want them there because they just are afraid of them. Fear is a big motivator for some of the human tiger interactions that are turn out negative for the tiger, and retaliation, as I said. So poison becomes an issue, but poison is also contributing to tiger decline because tigers consume other species that have been poisoned. And that gets in, lead, for example, gets in the tiger's bloodstream, and that's the end of that. Toxic pollution, industrialization, obvious. Hunting and trapping, for example, in Burma, they found when they established these recent reserves in the far north that one of the big issues beyond, they decided to site this tiger reserve in a very remote valley. And so they designated a certain size of the remote valley because it was very little human population in there. And all around this valley were different human threats to the tiger. And those included, for example, shotgun traps that are around opium. What's it called? You know, poppies that grow the stuff for opium production sites. They have these shotgun traps on the perimeter that shoot anything that comes in, but certainly tigers. And they also had problems up there with insurgency. You know, there have been several different armies that have been fighting against the government of Burma. One of them has been the Karen, who's been fighting against the so-called dictatorship in Burma. And the United States has clandestinely supported the Karen war for many years. And so warfare is a big one. The weapons production, the flooding of weapons. I mean, it wasn't until after World War II during World War II that all these weapons flooded into India because the United States wanted India to join in, or the U.S. faction, the Allied bloc wanted India to join in the war and fight against the Nazis and the other bloc, the Nazis and the Italians and the Japanese, etc. So all these weapons flooded into India, and suddenly the population of tigers went way down in India in 1942, 43, 44, 45. Climate change and severe weather is another reason. Sport hunting and collection for private zoos as pets. We have 7,000 or more tigers in the United States. Probably 50% of those are treated in very, what we would call, inhumane conditions, trapped in little spaces. They're taken as pets, as cubs, and most people don't want to keep them when they start to grow beyond a certain size. So suddenly somebody has to find a home or they're euthanized. And so sport hunting and trading in the United States is huge, and it involves the intelligence community. When I say that, it makes it sound like intelligence is a smart thing, and I'm talking about a form of terrorism. You know, the U.S. intelligence community is involved in all kinds of nasty stuff all over the world, and I've found connections to the U.S. intelligence community with the tiger trade in the central United States, Minnesota, Michigan, for example, Colorado. So these another reason the tiger populations are struggling in some places is because the prey populations, as you pointed out, they have to have, if they have a healthy population under them and the tiger population is healthy, it's because they can eat. So a large male Bengal tiger will be almost twice the size of a female, and not as big as the Manchurian, which is up to, which was 12 feet, or, but the Siberian tigers got up to 10 feet at one time. But now they're, the Siberian tigers, because hunting has been so extreme up in Siberia, they, the, and the trophy tigers were the biggest ones. The Siberian tiger size has, they are, the average size is smaller now. And my point was hunting for big game trophies has been a big one. Agriculture and aquaculture, I said, plummeting prey populations. In some of the places where tigers exist, for example, in 1997, the most famous big cat expert in the world, his name was Alan Rabinowitz, and I used to communicate with him in the 90s. He died in 2018. He's the one who established these parks in northern Burma, and he's also the one who established the Jaguar Corridor in Latin America. And Rabinowitz discovered a little deer, which is one of the tiger's foods, down in one of these places. I think it was in Burma in 1997. The deer had, we didn't even know about it. It wasn't even previously discovered. And it was a pretty small creature, a mammal, you know, ungulate, but it was unknown. And the point is, some of these places where these tigers are being, you know, conserved and at the same time threatened, there's still species that we don't even know about. I mean, we're not talking about the snow leopard, but nobody knows the snow leopard's range today. Nobody knows, even these big cat experts who put all this money and time into it. So, and the other threats to tigers are genetic isolation, which is the one you asked about. So any population that becomes genetic, that becomes geographically isolated, especially on an island, but not only. I mean, when I was writing about lions and tigers in India back in the 90s, when I was writing in the 90s, I was talking about these islands of biodiversity in the middle of India, where there were little ranges, little places like Sariska National Park, which is a tiny, tiny tiger reserve near Delhi. And it's almost not viable for tigers because it's so small, but there were some tigers there. They were eventually, they were gone after 1990, and they've been reintroduced since then. And the genetic isolation happens when there isn't enough of a population to breed. So it becomes a population bottleneck, or it's otherwise known as inbreeding depression. Inbreeding depression causes all kinds of genetic birth defects, for example. It can, it doesn't necessarily, but it, as it gets severe, it does. It causes immune collapse or immunocollapse or immune system deficiencies. It makes the tiger more susceptible, or any species more susceptible to an epizootic, which is an epidemic. That's the term for an epidemic among wildlife. And so the risks to the tigers are not only some of the possibilities of an epizootic coming from domesticated animals, such as deer or other cats or domesticated cats. Those could spread to tigers, but also just some disease or epizootic arising within the tiger population from some sort of a wild agent that could affect them. And then because they don't have enough diversity, they can easily all be wiped out. It's, you know, survival of the fittest, but if you're all at the same fit level, you know, nobody's going to survive. And so that's why the genetic diversity is essential. And that's why these corridors are essential. I think I covered all the, well, the tiger trade is, you know, people like the tigers, as I said, for the trade in parts. And they make handicrafts, they make jewelry, fur coats, fur rugs, you know, tiger tooth ashtrays, and just all this horrible stuff.
So what have led to the successes in at least slight recovery?
Well, like I said about tigers being traded in the United States, it's a big business. And so it's a brand. Tiger is a brand, just like the panda is a brand for WWF and the rhino is a brand for somebody else. And well, you know, these big bingos, we call them bingos, big NGOs. They're not about conservation. They're about business. The World Wildlife Fund, World Conservation, Wildlife Conservation Society, Fauna and Flora International, Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International, San Diego Zoo, National Geographic, Smithsonian, International Union for the Conservation of Nature. These are businesses. These tigers are brands. Some of them don't care if the tigers disappear, or maybe some people do care, but they're fooling themselves because they sit on the boards of these giant corporations, as well as on these so-called wildlife conservation organizations. They take in these incredible $300,000-$400,000 a year salaries just from one of their directorships, and they're tied to the military industrial complex in so many ways. So we're talking about corruption and again, back to branding and territorial competition between humans to control tigers and tiger parts and tiger populations and tiger breeding. You know, the whole zoo thing we haven't talked about, but, you know, this zoos receive a lot of money from the public. And so the value of a tiger to the zoo is substantial. They want these big predators, you know, and so they're willing to. And there's all kinds of, I said this, there's all kinds of corruption. And if we wanted to really get into how it works, we would switch and talk about gorillas, because that's where I did the deepest investigation into these organizations. So, but what was your question? Money. So,
no, my question was how to talk about how does a place actually increase? What are the success stories of what did they do to allow the tiger numbers to increase in the places where they have? What has been their plan?
Some of these reserves, they've managed to keep the people out, and other reserves, like we talked about with the Gur lion, they've let the people control the tiger population. And when the people have a say in things, when the small people with no money and trying to feed their families are given and empowered to take care of these species that they realize suddenly are so valuable to other people, then their own mentality begins to change. So in India, it's been a combination of designating reserves that are viable, education of the people, enforcement. And enforcement, of course, can get nasty because it becomes with the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund and the Jane Goodall Institute in Eastern Congo, it becomes paramilitary and it starts to involve, and as I said, involves intelligence operations. So as an example, let's talk about Alan Rabinowitz. Alan Rabinowitz, as I said, died in 2018, and I used to communicate with him. And he started out looking at cats in the 80s, I believe. And somewhere in the 90s, mid-90s, he started to look at questioning what were the tiger populations in Burma. And he went in somehow. He was able to go in the 90s at the height of the U.S. war against Burma, which is completely unknown. And he managed to spend 5 to 7 years setting up the world's largest tiger reserve it was the world's largest tiger reserve. And it was in northern Burma, and it was 4,100 square kilometers. And then the dictatorship came back to him and said, surprisingly, why didn't you ask for more land? So then they gave him another 13,000 square kilometers. And over the next 5 years, they designated what became a 23,000 square kilometer collection of protected areas that were connected by corridors in northern Burma. And because Burma has been a dictatorship, and it's because it's been closed to tourism, the numbers in Burma have gone up. India has a big tourist push. And so a lot of people like to go out to the game parks. And so that's another reason why India has been successful. But you know what? You nailed something earlier. If tiger populations and many other species are left alone, they increase. So in some places, they've designated core areas, which nobody can go in, not even biologists. And they've left the tigers alone, and their numbers have substantially increased. They've also stepped up patrols to remove snares and other forms of poaching, which is a major problem for tigers. And so I was watching this this talk given by Alan Rabinowitz once upon a time, and he said, this is a direct quote. This was in 2010, and he was, if you can watch it, it's a very impassioned little video by Alan Rabinowitz called Saving Big Cats. And this is his quote: "No matter how many protected areas I set up, I was losing. And at this point in time, 2010, I had set up about 8 protected areas, over 15,000 square kilometers of pristine habitat for these tigers to live. And I could not keep pace with humankind. I could not keep pace with the way people were killing and mistreating these big cats and other wildlife. But in particular, the way they were killing and mistreating these big cats." That was his plea in 2010 to try to get people to wake up to the fact that tigers are going to disappear if we don't change things. And so over the next 10 years, they did. Governments, individuals, money was thrown at the problem, more protection, and the tigers were left alone. So the numbers in some places have increased. That's a long answer to your question.
Well, thank you for all that. And we're pretty much out of time. And do you have any final things you want to say about tigers?
Oh, yeah, I love them. I think what's really interesting is, to me, one of the things that's really interesting is I'm not so interested in the struggles between biologists or, you know, classifiers or Linnaeus to classify and taxonomy animals, but I'm interested in the people's take on tigers. And so the native peoples in Kamchatka and the Far East and India and Indonesia and Thailand, all these native people, the little people that, you know, are shat on all the time and trodden into the earth, their creation stories involve, in many cases, involve tigers, their creation myths. And for example, It's bizarre in a certain and sad in a certain way that all the tigers in China are gone, because in Chinese mythology, the tiger, there are tiger constellations in the sky. There are numerous tiger constellations in the sky. And for example, the Big Dipper, the third star in from the right to the left, is named in some way related to belief in the tiger as one of the four major elements or animals or species in the pantheon of Taoism, which would be the tiger and the tiger and the tortoise and the crane. I wrote it down somewhere because I can never remember. The white tiger, the tortoise, the red bird, and the phoenix, and the dragon. And the tiger signifies the West. It's the energy of the West. It's associated with the season of fall, and the element metal and wind, as opposed to the other elements of fire and earth, for example. And it's universally attached to power, strength, and righteousness. And so there's this whole world of thinking out there about tigers that people have to dig for. And even then, often it's in a different language and a different cultural milieu. And to be able to tap into it and understand what humans who value nature have said about tigers and big cats, it's really eye-opening to go back, to go and look at, try to look at that, try to find the stories associated with Taoism and Feng Shui and the Naga people of India, for instance. The tiger was one of the three brothers, born of the union of the sky and the earth. And it's beautiful, sad, and wonderful. And that's the nature of the earth that we have. And I hope people will think a little bit about what they can do to stop the tiger trade from the United States, which is one of the biggest killers of this species.
Well, thank you for all that. And thank you for being in the program. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Keith Harmon Snow. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Mm-hmm.